Israel's perspective is, at the end of the day, there has to be regime change in order for this to have fundamentally been a success. And I'm not sure that's where President Trump is.
The people selecting the Supreme Leader will be conservatives, ideologues, hardliners. Even a selection during peacetime likely would have been a hardliner. Wartime selection probably makes this even more likely.
There are many different divides and schisms within the GCC on security, on energy, on other core national security issues. But in a way, what's happened with the Iranians targeting the GCC states is it's brought them together on one issue that there is no disagreement on right now.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point Class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, we're looking at the ongoing U.S. and Israeli strikes against Iran. Specifically, we're looking at the conflict's strategic dimension. Even more specifically, we're examining that strategic dimension from several points of view. First, you'll hear about the U.S. and Israeli strategic objectives and the decision to take military action, including not just U.S.-Israeli strategic alignment, but also where their objectives might diverge. Next, you'll hear what this conflict looks like from an Iranian point of view, where the regime's resilience and the country's military capability are under the greatest pressure they've faced in decades. And finally, there's a third strategic perspective that's really important to consider, that of the Gulf states, both collectively and individually, who have not only been pulled into the conflict as Iran has targeted them with missiles and drone strikes, but also are important players in the regional security balance. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point Class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, let's get to the discussion. The first guest I spoke to is Jonathan Panikoff. He has worked in the intelligence community, including as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East at the National Intelligence Council, and he is now the director of the Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative at the Atlantic Council. He shared his insights into the strategic thinking behind the decision by the United States and Israel to launch this military operation. Jonathan, thanks for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me again.
So I want to, listeners will be maybe familiar with you because you've been on, I think, twice before to talk about some things in the Middle East. Your background is in the intelligence community where you worked on Middle East issues extensively, including at the National Intelligence Council. You're now the director of the Scowcroft Middle East Security Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And, listeners are going to hear a bit later on in this episode from a guest, Sydney Late, looking at kind of what we're going to talk about today, Operation Epic Fury, these U.S. and Israeli strikes in Iran. They're going to hear from a guest who will kind of talk about this from Tehran's perspective and really what dynamics are in play inside Iran during this operation. But with you, I'd like to focus our discussion kind of on the perspective from Washington and to the extent possible also from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And as difficult as it can be to sort of extract this military operation from the sort of domestic political context in which most public discussions, at least in U.S. media, seem to be wrapped in, I do want to try to do so and really focus on the operation really, I guess, from a strategic and policy point of view. So in strategic terms, what we're seeing right now, if we think in terms of ends, ways, and means of strategy, right? If the means of this operation are largely U.S. and Israeli air power and U.S. sea power, and the ways are sort of intelligence-driven, precision strikes, I guess what are the ends is the big kind of fundamental question here. Can you describe kind of maybe the full range of strategic outcomes that the United States and Israel maybe would like to achieve with this operation?
Yeah, John, I think it's the right question. And I think one of the reasons that so many people are struggling with this, including me, is fundamentally that because the goals have been shifting from a U.S. perspective and were not clearly defined at the beginning, it wasn't therefore clear what the strategy was going to be. And without knowing fully what the strategy was going to be, some of those inputs have become harder. I think as we've gone along now, 6 days into this and seven or eight by the time the podcast lands, I think it's becoming clear that the U.S. has started to coalesce around a couple of things. One, it wants to fundamentally degrade, diminish, if not completely end, which I think is harder, Iran's ballistic missile program. It wants to decapitate the naval assets that Iran has so that they can't be a threat in the future in either the Strait of Hormuz or in other areas on the Iranian coastlines that are quite extensive. I think it wants to eventually get to the nuclear program. We haven't seen a lot, frankly, of focus on the nuclear program yet. I think that's been a little bit concerning to folks like me who are kind of waiting for this. There's still 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium from the summer when the US struck Fordo and Isfahan and Natanz, that there's a question of where that is and what is happening with that. But I think that all of those things are now coalescing. There's been this question on regime change, and I think this is going to be the one area that's going to be quite important fundamentally, that we may get real division between the US and Israel. Because I think Israel's fundamental perspective is at the end of the day, there has to be regime change in order for this to have fundamentally been a success. And I'm not sure that's where President Trump is. In fact, I think President Trump's view is going to be, look, I'd like there to be regime change, but if we get to 3, 4, 5 weeks in the war and some of those other end goals have been met, I think it's frankly easier for political reasons, yes, in part, but even for good policy reasons to say, look, we fundamentally diminished Iran. We've ended Iran's capability to serve as a threat to Israel, to Gulf Arab neighbors, to the US long term in the ways that it has. We now, therefore, are ready to declare victory and move out. And so long as you believe, which I tend to, that we're very unlikely to put in mass numbers of ground troops in Iran, that probably is going to be where I think we have to end. And strategically, I think the US will be able to say, look, we had a success that bought at least a number of years and degraded what was going to be clearly a sharp increase and a sharp threat of Iranian ballistic missile capabilities that was only going to grow. I think for Israel and certainly for the Iranian people, there's going to be a real concern about whether that falls short of their goals and whether that is sufficient to get to a new strategic outcome.
Well, you already answered my second question, which was, are U.S. and Israeli objectives aligned? So I guess I'll ask a slightly different question. And to the extent that there is any misalignment, was that misalignment there from the beginning of this operation, or is that a function of sort of maybe what sounds like U.S. flexibility in terms of what the ultimate objectives are, and maybe Israeli insistence on retaining those original objectives in place?
I think honestly, the answer to both of those is actually yes. In other words, I think the US, notoriously, and this administration in particular, is always quite flexible about the outcomes and goals. Look, there is a political calculation here that I think President Trump wants to be able to declare victory successfully, no matter what the outcome. I would argue that's not actually different than most presidents. I think most presidents want to. The difference here is there wasn't a normal policy process that was gone through to create the goals and the strategic objectives. And so that's creating, yes, some more inherent flexibility, but I think some confusion early on, especially for US allies, even for the American people, about what the ultimate goals are. For the Israelis, I think their view is all of the things that the US wants to achieve are fundamentally important and also goals of theirs. And so I don't think it'd be fair to say, look, that there's completely divergent goals. I think in the end, the difference is the Israelis are going to say, look, there has to be a way to get the regime out, and regime change fundamentally has to be the end of this. I think on the US side, we've already seen some of this signaling, and we saw it very early on, that it's going to have to be the Iranian people. The US, in I think the president's mind, are going to clear a pathway to do that through bombings, through leadership decapitations, which the Israelis have taken the lead on. But ultimately, it's the Iranian people who will have to make this decision. And I don't think that's completely wrong. I just think it's a question of, okay, well, then is there support? In other words, my guess is after the bombing stopped, the Israelis would be very, very supportive of continued, for instance, US and Israeli ISR over Iran to help the Iranian opposition. They might be very willing to consider very targeted strikes to help Iranian opposition. I don't know that the US is going to be there. And that's where I think we may see divergence longer term here in, another 3, 4, 5 weeks from now when we get to that point, if we get to that point. Fundamentally, I think at the end of the day, once the US decides it's over, I think the US will want to pull out. And it will be very hard at that point for the Israelis to continue a meaningful campaign. And then you're back to this challenge for the Iranian people. You're back to the challenges that many of us have been pointing out of, okay, well, how do the people actually do this? Nobody on the Iranian side and the opposition right now seems to have yet coalesced. Maybe it's happening behind the scenes and we're just not aware of it yet. It's very possible. But none of them seem to have significant weapons. That's a problem because as unfortunate as this, guns tend to trump words, and we know the regime is willing to use its weapons to ensure its own survival. So I think it's this long-term end goal that's going to become ultimately somewhat distinct on the goals, and it'll be a question of what happens when we get there.
At the risk of, I guess, getting too meta, you know, if we think about the concept of regime change, right, and we break it down, is a regime the people that form the government, or is it the form of the government? And then is to change a regime, does that mean replacing the people within it or fundamentally replacing the form of the government? And I guess given that, you know, that these are the two principal actors on one side of it, Israel and the United States, is there agreement on what would constitute regime change in this context?
Yeah, I think it's a great point because implicit in there is clearly how the president has been thinking of this. So rightly or wrongly, just to take a quick step back, look, I think one of the reasons the president was more willing to authorize this war is so far his actions, not just in the Middle East, but across the world in both his first and second term related to military action have largely been without significant consequence. And I don't want to downplay it completely, but if you go all the way back, especially with Iran, to the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the former Quds Force chief in the first term, there was a reaction, but it was relatively muted compared to what a
Sure.
lot of analysts, myself included, thought that it might be at the time and might lead to. You go more recently to the June strikes. Yes, there was a reaction to the U.S. base in Al Udeid, but it was quite well telegraphed. It was quite well known. And so I think there's been a view by President Trump that he can largely engage with some impunity, that the consequences won't be significant. That here is, I think, fundamentally different because the regime sees its actual survival at stake for the first time. And so I think what that means for regime change is really important because I think for President Trump, then he may be looking at it like he's looked at Venezuela. Not that we were going to be able to rendition the Supreme Leader Ali Ayatollah Khamenei, but that we might have an opportunity to kill him as we have, as the Israelis have killed him. And then maybe there's somebody else that could take his place that we could deal with. That may be President Trump's thinking. In fact, my guess is it's certainly playing in. I think that's a misread. The problem fundamentally is what comes next for the Iranians is far more likely to be the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps taking control in an even more meaningful way than they had. And that group is fundamentally ideological, especially at the senior leader levels. And so the idea now that you could have a you know, Vice President Delcy figure like that in Iran, I think is less likely. Now, if it's not the guards, if you have some fracturing internally, and I think that's possible, if you have other situations where the guards start to not have the same power, then do you have to change the same system completely? Maybe not in the US perspective, and maybe they'll be right. The Israelis are almost certainly on the no, the entire system has to be gone. The guards have to be gone. If you have the guards as fundamentally the dominant player at the end of this, then you largely are going to end up in the same system. I don't know if that's fully true. I think individual leaders matter. I think they've mattered more than they ever have before, more than structures and systems themselves. I think leaders can surprise you. But we're pretty far away, I think, from knowing internally what that internal structure could even look like. And the reality is, in the next 3 to 4 weeks, even some of the names, I don't love the Tehranology going on because there's a fairly moderate to high percent chance that many of those folks also will be targeted and be killed, and then
sure.
We'll be on to the next ones.
Sure. I want to shift gears a little bit and turn our attention to Iran's proxy network because, you know, the response of the groups within that network has been really interesting to watch. Hezbollah acted quite quickly by striking Israeli targets. Israel has mobilized reservists for, so far there have been small-scale incursions, but potentially larger-scale incursions into southern Lebanon. Do you think that this surprised Israel, given how much of Hezbollah's combat capability was eroded during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in the fall of 2024?
No, I don't think it surprised Israel. I mean, I think there's two things. I think once Khamenei was killed, I think there was probably going to be a view that there was, from Hezbollah's perspective, it had no choice, that it's always been on the margin, that it was going to have to attack. I actually think if you look at what Hezbollah has done, compared to where we were, say, 18 months ago or 24 months ago, the reaction is quite small in some ways. In other words, it's a reflection of Israeli success in fundamentally destroying and diminishing a lot of Hezbollah's capabilities. It was going to be hard to imagine that the group, which has pledged fealty to the Supreme Leader and personally to this Supreme Leader, in a way that a lot of the other partner and proxies of the Iranians have not, wasn't going to do something. And I think it's a mistake by Hezbollah's part because fundamentally it gave the Israelis a ready-made reason to go in and to take control. But it wasn't astronomical. I think the bigger question may be, are there going to be, is there more coming? Inevitably, we knew that there were still some capabilities left in Hezbollah's reserves. What else is left? I think the Houthis may be the biggest surprise here, to be honest, and to me a little bit about the decisions not to more aggressively strike.
And what do you
My
think is behind that? Because that is striking, particularly in comparison to Hezbollah's response, as well as the response of certain Shiite militias in Iraq, taking, aggressive violent action there. The Houthis have demonstrated a pretty obvious reticence to join in the conflict by, doing what they already have shown they have the capability to do, which is, targeting commercial and military ships at sea from their bases in Yemen.
It's a great point, and it's a good point, an important one about the Iraqi militias as well. I think on the Houthis, my guess is there's three things going on. One, there's always been, I think, too much, idea of boxing all of Iran's network together, that they're all proxies that are just going to be completely responsive. The Houthis have fundamentally their own political agenda, their own drivers. That's always going to cause them to not necessarily be as responsive as some of the others in the Iran threat network have been traditionally. And we've seen that before. I think there's a second part that may relate to Saudi Arabia. The Iranian decision to strike the Gulf and strike the Gulf so early, and the Saudis, right now, there's been detente with the Saudis for a couple of years now with the Houthis as they've worked towards what comes next. And I'm guessing that the Houthis are actually quite reticent to meaningfully get involved in a way that the Iranians might want because they don't want to ruin that detente with the Saudis. Now, there's an argument that if you strike Israel and the missiles, and obviously we saw this throughout the war with Hamas, between Israel and Hamas, that it would not have the same reaction by the Saudis. And that may be true, but the challenge is the Iranian decision making here to be so aggressive, I think, has really put the Houthis slightly on a back edge that they want to be really careful about whatever it is they do. And then there's a third part of this, which is, look, most of the Houthis' capabilities are coming from Iran. And I've got no doubt that the Houthis have got to be a little bit worried that, look, some of its capabilities have already been diminished by strikes by Israel. It's not clear how much they have left in their inventory. And so there's a real question there that, look, if the Iranian regime does not survive in the way that the Houthis have always expected that they would, will they also be challenged, frankly, to get resupply? Will they be able to continue to have the types of weapons in their inventory they did? Or do they have to be really, really careful about what they do choose to do and not do because they can't afford, for their own deterrence purposes, from their perspective, to waste anything now if it turns out the Iranians are not going to be able to resupply it 6 months from now? And so I think all of those things are playing in. And then the last thing that's just a bit more strategic is, look, I still think that there's a view right now that what's happening in Iran is probably that it's really trying to space out the use of especially short-range ballistic missiles and the medium-range ballistic missiles, that the inventory is low, especially of the launchers, more so than of the missiles. And it feels like it needs to have enough to cover the entirety of the war, no matter how long it goes. There is an alternative, perhaps red cell view that I think we can't completely dismiss, which is that this is part of a strategy, that we're only 6 days into this. This is still phase one. And what the Iranians are doing, as well as proxy groups like the Houthis, is that they're intentionally saving it for a bigger salvo later, after a lot of the interceptors from the Gulf, from Israel, from the US have been used. There's already questions about shortages of them, and then there'll be a decision to launch at that point.
So if we zoom out and we look again, really from Washington's perspective and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem's perspective, what are sort of, I guess, the realistic best case and worst case scenarios for this campaign? And not necessarily in the near term, because I think the near term, you can only really assess it at a tactical and operational level. And on both of those fronts, it's largely been successful. But if we look at it from a strategic perspective, in the midterm and sort of the long term, what are the realistic best case and worst case scenarios from both perspectives?
Yeah, I think they're actually quite different, which is a challenge. I think the Israeli best case scenario that I don't actually think is realistic, but I think many there do, is that this ends with a fundamentally different regime, and even if not a fully democratic regime, a regime that can be meaningfully engaged, that's no longer a threat to Israel, a regime that gives up its nuclear ambitions and gives up its ballistic missile ambitions, and most importantly, perhaps, or equally importantly, I should say, gives up its use of terrorist proxies throughout the region. I think the Israelis view that that really is the best case, and if we stick to it, we don't pull out early, we can get there. It'll take some blood, it'll take some treasure, but we can get there. And then that would have a fundamental, frankly, reorganizing of the entirety of the region to the benefit of Israel, in a way that many have been very frustrated with Israel, especially in the Gulf. But you would quickly see a coalescing, formally or informally, despite everything that's happened in Gaza, of an ability to have, frankly, a more integrated region that includes Israel. I think for the Israelis, the worst case scenario is actually that the US makes a decision to pull the cord early, declare victory early, and we are left with a regime that is frankly more of a Iranian Guards-led rump regime that is actually now more hardline, not less. There's some argument that's being made by a number of folks, including a colleague and great Iranian analyst named Karim Sajapour, who's at the Carnegie Institute. And Karim, I know's view is that, look, in some way, the Supreme Leader was a little bit of a break on some of the nuclear ambitions. That for a long time, you've had folks within the regime, some of them on the hardline side, wanting to go for it at a much quicker rate. And you could see that, and then that would mean more significant, frankly, battles to come, conflicts to come, with Israel and throughout the region. And I think that would really scare the Israelis and concern them. From the US perspective, I actually think that worst case is probably very similar, that you have a regime that ultimately is more hardline, not willing to negotiate, not willing to engage. I think while there's a dream of the Israeli best case scenario that you have a completely different regime, and there may be some who think that's possible. I think what for many the best case scenario is that you have a regime that is fundamentally, with this generation of leadership gone, not hostile to Israel, even if you have somebody from the Guards taking over, that they don't re-engage the nuclear program. Maybe they keep some of the ballistic missile program for its own deterrence. And you get a negotiated settlement at the end. Right now, the Iranians are just not going to agree to a political settlement. They don't think they can. But I think the US is hoping that eventually you get to a negotiated settlement where Iran gives up on its nuclear calculus, some of the terrorist calculuses, and then there might be something on the ballistic missile side that there's a negotiation. I think that would really bother the Israelis immensely. And so you could end up in completely two different strategic outcomes that one of us feels like it's a good solution on the US side and the Israelis feel like it's not. But that's where my guess is we probably are right now. But it could change again. By next week, this could all be shifted once again.
So as we do this sort of horizon gazing experiment, it is very much a foggy horizon. And you add on top of that the sort of lack of clarity about strategic objectives, the complexities of having perhaps imperfect alignment between the main warring parties on one side of this conflict. And it's a complicated situation. But I appreciate you joining me and sharing your insights onto this complicated situation.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Next, I spoke to Sydney Late. She spent years focused on Iranian strategic decision-making as a senior intelligence analyst. She joined me to share her understanding of Iran and to discuss what the current conflict looks like from an Iranian strategic point of view. Sydney, thanks so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So listeners will have heard previously in this episode a little bit about the kind of strategic perspective from Washington and also from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, the policy dimensions of what we're seeing now with Operation Epic Fury. I invited you on because I wanted to understand a little bit more and wanted to help listeners understand a little bit more about what this looks like maybe from Tehran's perspective and inside Iran, an Iran that is currently under bombardment by U.S. and Israeli air power, and in the case of the U.S., sea power as well. So I guess if we kind of, to start, I guess, to frame the discussion, we're talking about, look, the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei was killed in the opening wave of strikes. There's an open question, I think, about whether or not that means the regime is falling or whether or not, you know, it's, hey, this is plug and play and they can identify somebody else to put in that position. I suspect the answer falls somewhere in between there. But if we think of it as sort of a spectrum of regime fragility on one end and absolute regime resilience on the other end, I wonder if you can kind of give us some thoughts on where the Iranian regime sits on that spectrum.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the regime's been preparing for this scenario for a very long time. They've built mechanisms into place to ensure continuity. Everything they've done since 1979, when the current regime took over, is to ensure regime survival in this type of scenario. It's the primary reason the IRGC was created, to ensure regime survival. It's entrenched, it's influential, and it's pretty vast. It's up to around estimates 200,000 IRGC members, an additional 300,000 reservist volunteer besiege members across the country. Not only that, they also have concrete plans in place for succession of the supreme leader. These are written into the constitution. The death of the supreme leader alone, therefore, is not regime change in itself. They will ensure the regime kind of lives on. However, all that to say, they can survive the blow that we've seen so far, I think, but there's so many unknowns about what's next. Even between days 3 and day 5 of the operations, the objectives appear to be kind of changing based on Secretary of War's Hegseth statements. A couple days ago, he said missiles, Navy, nuclear capabilities, those were the clear objectives that we were looking toward. And today, he said we're starting to pave the way for regime change. So it really depends how much further the U.S. and Israel are kind of willing to go with this. Obviously, don't have access to the target list, but there are still a lot of people they'd have to take out to fully crush the IRGC and current regime. And they're not all going to be sitting in the headquarters that are kind of currently being struck right now.
And is there, you know, I guess even if you do, if you're a regime and you do put all of these mechanisms in place to ensure regime survival, when one person sits at the apex of that regime for decades, there's always the risk that regime survival does get very sort of inextricably linked with the survival of the person in that position. I think that that's probably one of the things that is going to be most interesting going forward, is how much that sort of institutional infrastructure that was put in place to ensure the survival of the regime maybe atrophied because there was so much stability with one person in that job.
It's true. They've only exercised this muscle once, only had one supreme leader succession back in 1989. So it's been quite a while. But as mentioned, it's outlined in the Constitution. We see them taking the steps that are outlined so far. Upon the supreme leader's death, that interim leadership council takes control. That's the president, the judiciary chief, and then a selected member from the guardian council. They take over decision making, and we've seen that happen already. Then you have the assembly of experts. They are responsible for convening and selecting the new supreme leader. The Constitution basically says they have as soon as possible to do this, but there's no real timeline laid out that we know of. Last time it was within a day today, and obviously it's taken quite a bit longer this time around. But Israel just said today that any new successor who is chosen has an immediate target on their back. They're going to be struck. So maybe there's some strategic thinking there that they're not in a huge rush to appoint someone new because of that. Or maybe the leadership council is pretty effective at this point, and it's kind of a consensus way to get through this current crisis. Last time, again, was a peaceful transition. This time they're in the middle of a conflict. So there's quite a bit of variables at play there. If I could get into the weeds for kind of a second to talk about succession. The Assembly of Experts is elected by the population every 8 years, but the Guardian Council vets who can run. So the Assembly of Experts is responsible for selecting the next Supreme Leader, but because of who's allowed to run for that, it pretty much ensures no opposition representation is on there. The Guardian Council itself is a 12-member council. It has quite a bit of influence in Iran. It supervises elections, it approves or disqualifies candidates, including for the Assembly of Experts, and it vetoes legislation that it deems either un-Islamic or at odds with the trajectory of the regime. It comprises six clerics that are selected directly by the Supreme Leader, as well as six lawyers who are nominated by the Chief Justice, and then also still have to be approved. So all that to say, the people selecting the Supreme Leader will be conservatives, ideologues, hardliners. Even a selection during peacetime likely would have been a hardliner. Wartime selection probably makes this even more likely, as they're trying to ensure a strong response against the United States and Israel and the attacks that they're sustaining. There have been some kind of potential candidates tossed around. These include Khamenei's son, Mojtaba. His wife and son were killed during the strikes. Also, Khomeini's grandson has been named as well. We can't say with any certainty who they might choose. Again, very little insight into the whole process. There's good reasons not to go with kind of blood relations. Mojtaba specifically, he's very tied in with the IRGC and Basij, but he does lack governing experience, especially in a time when it might be really needed. And the perception of nepotism might undermine the process or perceived legitimacy of the Supreme Leader position down the road. So again, just so many unknowns, a lot of names being thrown around. I think it kind of benefits Iran at this point to stick with that leadership council and kind of wait and see how these strikes proceed.
You know, a lack of governance experience is obviously perhaps important, but equally important, if you're well connected, you know, this is throughout history, even in the most sort of centralized authoritarian systems, there are still these fiefdoms and pockets of power and pockets of influence. And so I would imagine that behind the scenes, there's, you know, with the Basij, with the IRGC, with various elements of the IRGC, and elsewhere, you've got sort of maybe jockeying for power that takes place. Are there any indications that that is happening? And if so, if they're lining up against, you know, sort of in support of hardline or reformist candidates?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. If Mojtaba is selected, he's expected to be even maybe even more hardline than Khamenei himself, than his father, especially as he seeks revenge for his father and during a time of war. Right now, decisions are, a lot of the top decision makers were killed in the strikes against Khamenei. Iran confirmed the deaths of several high-ranking figures, including the Chief of Armed Forces Chief of Staff, the IRGC Commander-in-Chief, the Defense Minister, and Ali Shampani, who's held several very high-profile positions in the government, was very influential. Most recently was serving as advisor to the Supreme Leader and was secretary of the newly formed Defense Council, which they had formed after the June 12-day war. Iran has replaced the commander of the IRGC, so that person is likely very involved in decisions and planning the strategic trajectory of retaliation. The current Supreme Council for National Security Secretary Larijani was not killed in strikes. That position typically holds quite a bit of power and influence in planning strategic directives. So he's likely very much involved. in discussions. And then you have all the individual leaders within the IRGC jockeying for their own positions to fill some of those that have been taken out, likely leveraging personal connections, as well as infighting and things like that, that to boost themselves into those now open positions.
So if we sort of, you know, this discussion so far that we've had has sort of been predicated on the assumption that all of the kind of institutional processes in play and the mechanisms in, that have been put in place are going to take place and that there will be a succession and these things will happen. Obviously, you know, in the hours really after the operation was launched, we had the president, you know, calling on Iranians to stand up, saying this is your best opportunity to take back your country, to take back your government. There have been reports that the United States has been encouraging anti-Iranian Kurdish militias that are currently in northern Iraq to enter, to go into Iran and, you know, do some things, so to speak. We did see, you know, 2003, the U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq. We had a plan to topple a dictator. And then when we did, we unleashed a whole sort of a host of maybe unforeseen and in, you know, in hindsight, for perhaps they shouldn't have been unforeseen, but unforeseen forces, political forces, violent forces. Is there any, you know, possibility that that's something that we could still yet see take place in Iran?
I think so, definitely. I think not yet, but definitely is something to watch out for. Unlike Iraq, again, the supreme leader death does not equal regime change. There's still that kind of plan in place. There's still quite a presence of IRGC maintaining control and things like that. So for now, especially in cities where you have the presence, the IRGC presence, it's going to stay pretty locked down. But there is a huge mixed population in Iran, much more ethnically diverse than Iraq. So you have, it's only about 60% Persian, 25% is Azeri, and then another 10 to 15% each of Kurds and Baluchis. So the Kurds and Baluchis are Sunni, the others are mostly Shia. Then you have the rural-urban divides within the country. You have, as in many countries, more moderates in urban areas and more kind of conservatives in the rural areas. So you have divides along various lines like that. Talking about arming the Kurds, even the Kurds are not a unified group. You have, just as we saw in Iraq and as well as Syria, there's so many different Kurdish groups with ideological differences. I won't pretend to be a Kurd expert, but some are very religious, whereas some are have a more communist bent, for example, among the groups that are in Iran. Can they surmount those differences and unify? They showed some unity following the recent crackdown in January. Some of the leaders appeared at a joint press conference in February, which kind of was the first biggest show of unity that we've seen among the Iranian Kurds. So that may be promising. But it's unclear what the end game there would be. The Kurds likely want to carve out some territory, as they've always kind of sought to get territory of their own. But I always ask, what's ever gone wrong with arming an opposition group? Sure. And then finally, there's also a historic ISIS presence in Iran that I think often gets overlooked. It goes a little bit under the radar compared to the other ISIS branches, because especially in a country like Iran, they've had to operate that way. But they'll almost certainly try to take advantage of the chaos and distraction among the security forces to renew operations.
So is there any sort of unifying force given this, you know, the fact that this is not a homogenous sort of block of people that all either support or oppose the current regime? Is there a political figure or maybe a set of ideas or something around which opposition to the regime could coalesce?
Honestly, I find this hard to believe. It's been studied for quite some time, and no one's really come up with a compelling candidate or group that has really encompassed all of the opposition. There's dozens of opposition groups with as many different goals and leaders out there. Those leaders are all kind of jockeying for power now, probably undermining each other. Second of all, there's they're all most or all of them are outside of Iran and have been for years, if not decades. They're not internal to the country. So it's going to be hard to unify people within the country to support someone who's been in exile for dozens of years. Pahlavi has been a name that's been kind of thrown around. He probably the most prominent name, but he has his own downsides. Many saying they don't want to return to someone who has ties back to a monarchical system that they already did away with. But again, this assumes an organic path. I don't want to assume anything in the current situation, trying not to rule anything out. If the US or other forces decided to kind of force the issue by emplacing a candidate and putting someone out there, maybe a population would get behind the left's or evil, so to speak. But I just don't see it happening organically where groups coalesce together and come around one of the opposition figures.
So you mentioned kind of at the outset, the IRGC, that it was, you know, it exists for, you know, to protect the regime. It is far and away the most well-known, you know, globally Iranian military force, but it's not the only military force. The National Army, which is larger in terms of manpower, perhaps not so in terms of the resources that they're afforded, also exists. Is that sort of that sort of dichotomy, having the IRGC and the Artesh, the National Army, is that something that could factor into, you know, I guess the ultimate long-term outcome?
That could be a wild card. And there has been talk over the years about kind of causing a divorce between the two organizations. The Artesh, just for some history, the IRGC, again, was created in 1979 to protect the regime. It answers to the supreme leader. It's ideologically driven. They're true believers in the regime, and they will not diverge from that path. The Artesh, by contrast, is a nationalistic organization. It views itself as more the defender of Iran as a nation rather than the Islamic Republic as a regime. That said, the IRGC calls most of the shots, controls the missiles, has led the responses to the crackdown a couple months ago. The Artesh, as far as I'm aware, was not involved in any protest suppression and typically has not been in the past. They've also not been as targeted in U.S. or Israeli airstrikes like the IRGC has. So I think the strikes themselves seem to be making that distinction, which may help in the future in setting them up. Notably, I've seen some reports recently that they're, and again, I always kind of take these with a grain of salt, but about a 14% defection rate among Artesh in some areas in the West, which kind of aligns with that Kurdish region. So that might make sense there if they're preparing some type of operations. But that's something to watch for. If we see greater defection numbers among the Artesh, that could certainly help kind of turn the tide and galvanize populations' confidence in the possibility of overthrowing the regime. I will say right now, as we talk about kind of the will to fight in general among the population, I imagine they're pretty scared. They're not sure about any guarantees of regime overthrow. They're concerned maybe the U.S. might ultimately come back and allow the current regime to stand. So without significant change in regime leadership and a clear signal that the regime is actually over, I think they're going to be reluctant to just rise up and attempt protests and to overthrow the regime on their own, especially as operations are ongoing and there's so much uncertainty there. But again, we could see that change if the Artesh became involved. We'll see what happens with the Kurdish operations as well, if that happens. Just a few things to kind of keep an eye on for sure.
Well, it's a complex place like any country is. And I want to thank you for joining me and shedding some light on some of the complexities that are almost inevitably going to have a bearing on how things play out in the days, weeks, and perhaps months ahead. So thank you, Sydney.
Thank you.
Finally, I spoke to Rory Miller. He is a professor of international politics at Georgetown University in Qatar, where he is the director of the Small States Research Program. He sheds light on the strategic perspective of both the Gulf Cooperation Council as an organization and the individual perspectives of its member states.
Rory, thanks for joining me on the MW podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you very much.
So listeners will have heard, kind of in two previous segments, a discussion about the U.S. and Israeli strategic and policy dimension of the ongoing conflict in Iran and regionally. They also will have heard kind of what this looks like from inside Iran in terms of the discussion of regime fragility versus regime resilience, what succession looks like, what survivability looks like in that context. As I was having those discussions, I really realized there's another perspective that's missing here, because this has become a regional conflict in a lot of different ways. You are a professor at Georgetown University, Qatar, where you also lead the Small States Research Program. I'm really thrilled that you agreed to come on to kind of share some of your insights onto those regional perspectives. So to sort of kick off, the Gulf Cooperation Council convened in the wake of the initial strikes. They issued a condemnation of Iran's retaliatory response in the region. Can you talk about how united maybe the GCC is in that context, and also whether or not maybe there are any sort of schisms or strategic divides between how they all sort of perceive this ongoing conflict?
All right. Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to speak with you again. This is an important issue, and you can take it in a vacuum of the last week or two, or you can look at it more broadly as part of a continuum. And what I would say with this, roughly speaking and in simple terms, there are many different divides and schisms within the GCC on security, on energy, on other core national security issues. But what you have unique here, where you can say that there is less disagreement and less inherent reason to compete with each other on this issue, is that they are all targeted, and they are all targeted by an actor who they have had different perspectives and relationships with, positive, negative, at different times. But in a way, what's happened with the Iranians targeting the GCC states is it's brought them together on one issue that there is no disagreement on right now. And that issue is that, why are you targeting us when this is not a war we started or wanted? And I think that is an important baseline to begin with, because that's where you're going to see future commonalities and differences evolve from.
Yeah, it's for any of us who have flown to Dubai, transited Dubai, been to the airport, it's one thing to be able to expect that Iran might retaliate by launching missiles and drones at U.S. bases in Bahrain and Qatar, elsewhere. But to target sort of civilian infrastructure like that was perhaps a surprise to some of us. Should it have been? And were Gulf countries surprised at the breadth of the response from Iran?
Yeah, I mean, look, these countries are not homogenous. They have different strategic priorities, different economic priorities, different economic resources, and different geographic locations. And so when you're thinking about preparing for something like this, some actors will have focused on some issues more than others. So, for example, the Qataris would have looked at the U.S. base, which has already been a target of one Iranian bombing in the summer. And they would have thought in terms of the U.S. military infrastructure. Bahrain has the 5th Fleet. The UAE, as you said, is a global hub for travel and tourism and property investment and all the things we know about Dubai. So, of course, their planning might have taken different aspects. But I would say one thing. To some degree or another, the militaries of the GCC have been planning for this eventuality as a worst-case scenario. But they have also been planning to avoid this eventuality. And they have invested heavily in terms of selling a narrative, diplomatic maneuvering, diplomacy with great powers, economic and financial diplomacy. They have used every instrument available to them to try and prevent this from happening. So you have two kinds of planning that have gone up to this crisis. One is planning so that this does not happen, and planning if it does happen. And of course, what we've seen is, in terms of their military response, it has been pretty successful in terms of air defenses and defensively protecting their populations, both citizens and residents. But if you're saying, were they planning on an active day-to-day basis for this attack to happen? No. I mean, I'm not saying there were not, and I've heard that there was possible exceptions, that some of the GCC states were not wargaming this sort of eventuality. But most of their time and effort was going into trying to ensure that this did not happen.
Was there, I guess in the wake of the initial strikes, was there a sense within the GCC countries then that all of that, you know, had failed? And that's not to, you know, to denigrate their efforts, but sometimes, the best of efforts run into a great power who's determined on going another way.
I mean, look, fail may be a bit premature because we haven't seen the outcomes yet, but definitely this was not the intended outcome of all the efforts they'd put on to prevent it. Let's put it that way. And that goes even as in terms of the short term back to President Trump's visit to the Gulf states in May 2025, when they pulled out all the stops to demonstrate their value to a superpower in the hope that he would take their interests into account before he acted. So objectively looking at it from that perspective, they haven't succeeded. But in terms of how they can mitigate the crisis now, and in terms of how these long-term investments in diplomatic, economic, financial, and other relationships may come to help them and come to their aid in the future as we try to work or find an exit from this is yet to be answered. But there's no doubt that this was not the intended outcome of all their financial, diplomatic, and other efforts to demonstrate the usefulness to President Trump, for sure.
And so right now we've seen, as you mentioned, it's been the military defensive response on the part of the Gulf states has been reasonably successful, I think we can say. Are there mechanisms for military coordination within the GCC or parallel structures that enable sort of coordination within, you know, within that context of air defenses, or are these, you know, these states essentially doing it independently?
So there, you know, the GCC was created at the beginning of the 1980s to deal with the threat of the Iranian Revolution and then the Iran-Iraq War. There were other secondary issues as well. The Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement made them a bit more vulnerable because they looked to Egypt. Certainly Saudi Arabia did. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It was an unstable time, much like the period we live in. And so the GCC came together in the face of these kind of external threats. But it was never developed from the get-go as a military or security organization, in part because there was a significant suspicion over the motives of Saudi Arabia as the dominant actor, and also because they did not have the capabilities in the 1980s. Some of them, these countries were only a decade old in terms of their independence. They did not have the capabilities to provide for their own security. So from the very beginning, it came together as a defensive organization to address external threats. And they actually have had quite a good record of that. Now, some observers are quite critical of the GCC for not building a military capability that can be offensive as well as defensive over the last 50 years. But the European Union is even older.
Sure.
And you could argue in a more stable neighborhood and has not managed to do that to any great extent, as even this crisis demonstrates very clearly. But on a defensive level, when there have been crises in the region, they have managed to come together, work together, put aside their differences. And in that sense, the GCC has been quite effective. Now, that's the first point. The second point is in terms of operationally, in terms of missile defense, this was always one of the sensitive issues alongside intelligence sharing and cooperating over energy that you really found reluctance among most member states to work on, because as you know, as well as I do, to have a coherent and cohesive and effective regional air defense capability, it needs full cooperation, interoperability, and you also need to have early warning systems in part of that region that benefit some countries in that region more than others. And while the political and diplomatic climate was not, very clearly facilitating that among these countries, you had a reluctance to move forward with that. The second reason was, from the 1990s onwards, all of the GCC states rather to develop their military partnerships with the US rather than with each other. And the third reason was that when you start thinking about building a capability that's shared in terms of air defenses, you have to start pooling resources. And none of these countries are buying in at all to this idea of giving up sovereignty or control of their own finances to a regional organization. So that's where we were up until the 2015s. And then Obama tried very explicitly to force the GCC states to start working together to have their own GCC missile defense capability. And he basically tried to link US military technology transfers to GCC rather than individual countries. But there was a lot of pushback against that. It was post-Arab Spring. There was a lot of sensitivities and security concerns, and that didn't work either. And so where you are now is you have a regional grouping of six countries with different strategic postures and security priorities, and with different relationships with Iran, different relationships with Israel, who haven't yet mastered or had the motivation to work together to build a mutual air defense capability, but are doing it mostly in tandem with the United States and very effectively. I think the big question in terms of what you're asking is, post-crisis, will you see a real drive towards a shared defensive capability that's in the benefit of all six countries, regardless of what the threat is?
And does this make that more likely?
It makes it more likely for one reason. Because all the previous significant threats that these countries have faced have not been faced by all of them equally. So when Saddam invaded Kuwait, he invaded Kuwait. That was not good news for Saudi and the others, but it wasn't Kuwait.
Right.
The Arab Spring, it was Bahrain. The others were nervous, but it wasn't so bad. The Gulf crisis, the blockade of Qatar, it was Qatar. But this is, with the exception of Oman to an extent, this is the one major regional or even global crisis where all of them are facing the same consequences and the same detrimental effects. And so this may be a driver that will force them to put other long-term and short-term differences aside. And I'll say one other thing. If this had happened 7 or 8 years ago, it would have been even less likely that you would have seen cooperation, because in the context of the war in Yemen led by Saudi and the UAE, in the context of the blockade of Qatar, in the context of basically the sidelining of the GCC because of those matters, that's a different day's conversation, it wouldn't have been feasible. But over the last 3 years, the GCC states have done a lot to try and rebuild the GCC brand. Now, of course, right now, the Saudis and the UAE have certain differences over East Africa and over Yemen. But this, I would say, will be overwhelmed and marginalized to some extent in the medium term by the threats they're facing from Iran.
How are populations in the region sort of responding to this?
Okay, well, there's three or four ways to think about this. Look, I work on small states. Yeah. And one thing, as we know, all small states have is they lack strategic depth. It's no coincidence that the two largest territorial actors in the GCC, Oman and Saudi Arabia, have been the most able to act normally. Now, partly that's because the Iranians haven't targeted Oman too much. But it's also because these are big countries territorially that have many different power centers and centers of population. But Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, these are small, you know, city states to a greater or lesser extent. And so the populations there, both expat and citizen, have really been under pressure in the last week. And I would say that that's a shared experience that in one way can only bring these actors together, and also linking back to our last discussion, will be an important consideration when you start seeing these countries try to cooperate militarily, because they've all suffered the same fate. Again, sure. Not like the Kuwaitis on their own in 1990-91, or the Bahrainis in 2011, or the Qataris in 2017. These guys are experiencing something quite traumatic, and it is traumatic, quite unique to their experience, and they're all having to deal with it. So I would say that what you have now is you have a, and I'm being general here, and again, it's not a homogenous group of countries, because obviously Bahrain has a bigger Shia population and there has been some protests in support of Iran. Mm-hmm. Even in some parts of the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, you have a significant Shia population, as you know. But what I would say is this, and the Omanis have always seen themselves closer for historical and geopolitical reasons. But what I would say is this, is that over the last week, events have evolved in a way that I think you will start seeing quite a divide between those who want, and I don't like to use this word, but maybe it's appropriate, basically want payback for being targeted when they consider themselves having nothing to do. And some who will consider this whole crisis as a function of the relationship with the United States and the West. And so I think governments will have to start managing that very pronounced divide, you know? And I think it's not so much a scenario where these countries are all going to unite together under the threat of Iran. Absolutely. No one appreciates what Iran has done. But I think there'll be those who just look at that and go, this is the reason, this is the issue. Iran has attacked us unjustifiably, and we need to respond in kind, if not militarily, but then economically, diplomatically, and politically going forward. And in terms of our allies and our friends, and those who say, well, we were just, you know, we were just collateral damage for decade-long relationships with the US that has not been there to protect us the way we want.
One of the things that listeners will have heard in the previous discussion with Jonathan Panikoff, who I know you know, is the perhaps divergence of strategic objectives between the United States and Israel. Israel's are perhaps a bit more maximalist, full regime change, whereas the US perhaps has objectives that are a bit more flexible in terms of maybe not regime change, but personnel change, and, you know, commitments short of regime change that include, you know, some real changes in the nuclear program, missile program, what have you. What are within the GCC, within these individual governments and as the organization as a whole, what are sort of, I guess, the optimal strategic outcomes, not only in the near term, because the near term is about survival and you know, a lower order of kind of strategic requirements and needs. What do the governments think is maybe a realistic midterm and long-term outcome from this conflict?
Well, I think it's premature to talk about it both on a national level and in a sort of corporate GCC level, because the corporate GCC level is something that may come from this crisis down the road.
Sure.
Right now, it is independent states in the region who happen to be members of the GCC who are going to prioritize their own interests and those of their neighbors when and if it coincides with their own. Now, there's not going to be a ceding of sovereignty, or there's not going to be, you know, a prioritization of other countries' priorities on certain issues. That may come because of this shock, but it isn't there now. So what I would say to you is, again, these are not homogenous countries. They have very different views on how to deal with Iran. Going back to the Iran-Iraq war, by the way, you know, where they were not attacked to the extent they have been this week, although Kuwait was to a certain degree. But they had very different views on how the war should end. They had very different views of what their relationship with Iran and Iraq should be after the war. So what I would say is you can't assume that they can address this through the GCC, and you can't assume that they will have the same views on what's the best for their interests in the middle term. What I would say, though, is two things. This is a stark reminder of something some leaders in the region have been saying for years, which is we need to find regional frameworks to defuse conflicts before they occur, because we cannot just be reacting to the decisions and the actions of external actors and other regional actors who we have no mechanisms or frameworks to engage with. And so I think, and there are no good outcomes to this, because as you said, to take one example, a country like Dubai is very reliant on stability, security. All the Gulf states have benefited greatly from building up this narrative of an oasis of calm and stability in a wider MENA region that's unstable. They have benefited hugely from stability, security, and order. And we live in an era, which this week has typified, of instability, insecurity, and disorder. So this is no good outcomes, but to answer your question explicitly, in the midterm, the best I think that you can hope is to remove the threat of Iran. Now, that is not to remove Iran. That is not to, you know, defeat Iran or to, you know, because I don't think that's viable, or to have a regime that is pro-American. It didn't work in Iraq and it didn't work in Afghanistan. I'm not sure it's going to work here. But to find a modus vivendi with Iran where this missile threat is not hanging over their heads, and then to build on the security front a framework where future crises can be addressed in a way that they can either be defused or reduced. That's, I think, the best case scenario in the middle term. In the longer term, I think something like that being institutionalized and bringing out outside actors would be something that a lot of these countries would be very in favor of now. But I think also in the longer term, an optimal outcome would be that, I mean, well, two. One, that the US stops being a major contributor to instability and uncertainty in the Gulf region. That's super important. And two, that Israel really reconsiders its approach to engaging with the wider MENA region. Because there are two issues that are in many people's minds, and quite rightly, I think, real. You know, it doesn't matter what you build on a local level if you have the US and Israel causing havoc, to be blunt.
Right. Well, Rory, thank you very much for joining me. Your perspective, as always, is really, really useful as we sort of try to just kind of develop an understanding of how we should process and think through what comes next in this conflict. So thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.